Everybody, good to see y'all. So, today I'm going to talk about two of my favorite things. That will be experimental music and zazen. More specifically, I'm going to look at an example. So we're going to look at a piece and talk a little bit about the Suringama Sutra. Dave actually recommended this sutra, and I was leading a deep listening workshop, which, by the way, is like a kind of like a practicum developed by Paul and Oliveris, another composer we'll talk about at some other point. But he was talking about it, and then I read it, and I was like, wow, this is really great stuff to read, especially coming from a musical background. It talks about methods for realizing the true self, and it kind of, not to spoil it, but kind of comes that sound is a great method to do that. So it seemed really appropriate. But also, some specific parts, you know, really seem to tie into some concepts and practices involved with experimental music. And I've kind of had this impression in general, just really seemed to be a lot of crossover between making experimental music, performing it, going to concerts, all that. For example, even like a quiet experimental music concert that you might go to, it's that there's that feeling of nobody says it, but it's don't move. Just sit, you know what I mean? And when it's a quiet experimental music piece, you can become increasingly aware, not just of the intentional sounds that are made, but of also the environmental sounds. So I'm going to kind of go back and forth between these two things a little bit. Brief little introduction. Also, experimental music and Zen. There's history there. John Cage, who may or may not know, wrote the piece Formants in 33 Seconds, where nothing is played intentionally. And that's the piece. It caused a lot of people were upset. Some people were floored. Some people thought it was great. But it was certainly a really historically important piece of music. And had a lot of influence for sure. And had a lot of influence on the person we're going to talk about today, which is David Dunn. Oh, also, just a little bit more context on that. All these composers, by their own words, are influenced by Buddhism in some capacity, some varying degrees, others, and specifically Zen, too. Cage studied with D.T. Suzuki, for example. And that was a big part of his kind of philosophy, was very much influenced by that stuff. So the first person we're going to talk about is David Dunn, who is actually the most recent one. And this piece was done 1997, 1998. And so there's no intentional sound making. It's a silent piece, so to speak, for intentional listening, which is kind of its own unique type of thing anyway. But we'll get more into that. But it's something that I think there's a lot to explore there. And there are other pieces like this, but not many. So to me, it's also kind of like a little bit creatively inspiring to just kind of like, I don't know, stew on that. So, okay, that's a little introduction. Now let's get to the sutra. So, Suringama Sutra, little context. Anandas gets lured or tempted into a house of courtesans, and then he is saved by Manjushri. And so the sutra erupts into a dialogue between him and Shakyamuni Buddha and where he went astray. So the first thing that I want to talk about that comes up is this thing. This is on the conditioned mind and the true mind. Okay, so I'm just going to go ahead and read this. It's not too long. Ananda, what are the two fundamentals? The first is the mind that is the basis of death and rebirth and that has continued since time without beginning. This mind is dependent on perceived objects, and it is this mind that you and all beings make use of and that each of you consider to be your own nature. The second fundamental is full awakening, which also has no beginning. It is the original and pure essence of nirvana. It is the original understanding, the real nature of consciousness. All conditioned phenomena arise from it, and yet it is among those phenomena that beings lose track of it. They have lost track of this fundamental understanding, though it is active in them all day long. And because they remain unaware of it, they make the mistake of entering the various destinies. Okay, so he's outlining two kinds of mind, which it's kind of tricky, but I mean, whatever. I feel like every talk in this way should kind of come with some sort of caveat that we're using words, and words are going to not really be the thing anyway. But it is kind of interesting, there's a two-ness here talking about the conditioned mind and the true mind. But I do think I mean, obviously, it does point to something, which he'll go on to describe further. So the one mind, maybe ego mind, could be a nice translation for that, and the other maybe more fundamental awareness. That wouldn't be it either, but it points to something. So it continues. Ananda, because you now wish to know about the path of calming the mind and wish to be subject to death and rebirth no longer, I will question you again. Then the Duskmon raised his golden-hued arm and bent his five fingers, each of them marked with lines in the shape of a wheel, and he asked Ananda, did you see something? Ananda said, I did. The Buddha said, what did you see? Ananda said, I saw the Duskmon raise his arm and bend his fingers into a fist that sends forth light, dazzling my mind and eyes. The Buddha said, when you saw my fist emit light, what did you see it with? Ananda said, all of us in the great assembly saw it with our eyes. The Buddha said to Ananda, you have answered that the Duskmon one bent his fingers into a fist that sent forth light, dazzling your mind and eyes. Your eyes can see my fist, but what do you take to be your mind that was dazzled by it? Ananda said, the Duskmon has just now been asking me about my mind's location, and my mind is what I have been using to determine where it might be. My mind is that which has the capability of making such determinations. The Buddha exclaimed, Ananda, that is not your mind. Love it. I didn't include this, but prior to this, there's a whole kind of discussion on where is the mind? Where is the location of the mind? And it goes through a series of, I don't even have my book on me, I'm so stupid. It goes through a series of, Ananda says it's in my body. He says it's outside my body. He says it has no location. And the Buddha's like, it's none of that. So that's kind of the idea. And it's something I think really, really good to stew on. Just that. Where is the mind? I mean, obviously in a kind of Cartesian worldview, which unfortunately I've been subjected to since I was very young, there's this idea that the mind is right here. It's our head. It's right here. And that's what's happening. That's where the center of our consciousness, that's where we are. And it just doesn't really seem to be the case, at least to me anyway. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. But it also gets into the thing of, we're talking about mind. I've heard people talk about heart-mind being a better translation. So it's not just like brain. We're talking about a more expansive or inclusive term for consciousness. But that's not even it either, because we're really talking about reality. Okay, so yeah, the Buddha says, Ananda, that is not your mind. Startled, Ananda stood up, placed his palms together, and said to the Buddha, if that is not my mind, what is it? The Buddha said to Ananda, it is merely your mental processes that assign false and illusory attributes to the world of perceived objects. These processes delude you about your true nature and have caused you, since time without beginning and in your present life, to mistake a burglar for your own child, to lose touch with your own original everlasting mind, and thus you are bound to the cycle of death and rebirth. From the lion seat, he reached out and circled his hand on the crown of Ananda's head and saying to him, the Duskmon has often explained that all phenomena that come into being are nothing more than manifestations of the mind. All things that are subject to the principle of cause and effect, from the largest roll to the smallest mote of dust, come into being because of the mind. If we examine the fundamental nature of each thing in the world, Ananda, down to even the smallest wisp of grass, we will see that all have reality. Even space has a name and attributes. Given that, how could the clear, wondrous, pure mind, the mind that truly understands and is the basic nature of all mental states, itself lack reality? But if, as you insist, that which makes distinctions and is aware of them, which knows and understands them, is indeed the mind, then that mind would necessarily have its own essential nature, independent of its involvement with objects, with visible objects, sounds, odors, flavors, and objects of touch. Yet now, as you listen to my Dharma, it is due to the sounds that you can distinguish my meaning. Even if you were to withdraw into a state of quietude in which all seeing, hearing, awareness of taste, and tactile awareness ceased, you would still be making distinctions among the shadowy objects of cognition in your mind. I'm not demanding that you just accept that this distinction-making capacity is not the mind, but examine your mind in minute detail to determine if a distinction-making capacity exists independent of its perceived objects of awareness. That would truly be your mind. If, on the other hand, your distinction-making capacity does not have an essential nature apart from its perceived objects, then it too would be a perceived object, a shadowy mental object. Perceived objects are not permanent, and when that mind ceased to exist such that it had no more reality than a turtle with fur or hare with horns, then your Dharma body would cease to exist along with it. Then who will be left to practice and to perfect patience with the state of mind in which no mental objects arise? At that point, Ananda and the others in the great assembly were utterly dumbfounded. They had nothing to say. Okay, so there's a lot in here, right? Some things to point out, and I think that this will be a nice transition into talking about the piece we're going to look at, is this thing of the mind not being independent of the objects it perceives. And I think that's one thing that kind of comes up to, which, I mean, I don't know. That's just true, right? If you hear something, it's not that that's separate and this consciousness here in the head is happening. It's they're together. They're part of something. And even in a situational context, it's like this situation is exactly this situation. Like you take one person out, it's not that situation anymore. If you're hearing something, you take that sound out, that's not that sound anymore. You know what I mean? But with philosophy and with a lot of music that's kind of prevalent, it isn't thought of that way. Certainly in kind of classical music theory, you take a piece of music and by and large, historically, it's like the music is the score. You break it down into components, into melodies, into pitch, into duration, into formal structure. And that's like thought of as separate. But that's not really what's happening, right? When a piece of music plays, there's so much more happening. The context, the environment, the soundscape, the people involved, the experiences that they bring with them, the temperature of the room. It's all part of that whole thing. And we're all participating in perceiving that. So, yeah, there's a lot in there. I'll probably come back more to that. But I think that's a good place to move on into our musical example. So, purposeful listening in complex states of time, David Dunn. So, there's a little introduction here. Oh, yeah, this is great. For solo listening. The meaning of music cannot be found within the mere structure of notes and or their semiotic reference. There is no point-to-point correspondence of communicative intent and reception, and the extent to which there could be would be a commentary on its triviality. For myself, the familiar information theory model of emotional and expressive communication through music has become untenable. Even though I probably never did accept it, I now consider it to be an extreme case of consensus misplaced concreteness. The attempt to identify objective content of expression within the musical object smacks of all the failed post-Kantian attempts to assign mind to a specific locus. Music is the same as mind, a distributed ecology of communal signification where meaning arises from the conditions of mutual conspiracy. I like that, a mutual conspiracy. Expression and meaning in music exist in the agreement to circumscribe a boundary upon a seemingly infinite set of superabundant associations and uses. In other words, how much you buy into the culture you are born into is not merely a matter of personal taste, but to assume that the meaning you have attributed to your music is a universal attribute is simply stupid. Kind of, yeah. So I think one thing to talk about here that he, obviously this piece, heavily influenced by 433 and Cage and all that. But one thing that Cage and him both were all about was disentangling ourselves from the associations and the expectations that we have with sound. And I think that's predominant for most of us, and it happens to everyone. I mean, like in some capacity, I don't know if you could ever totally disentangle from that, but just a simple idea or emphasis on kind of hearing at a more fundamental nature what a sound can be. So for example, if we hear the traffic outside, you might think car. Okay, well, what's it like to hear it without thinking car? What's it like to hear it without identification with some kind of prior conceived idea, or at least becoming aware of it? What does that bring back for you? What kinds of memories does it bring back for you? What history does it bring back for you? Can you experience it in a more fundamental way? Sounds just as sounds. And that's kind of a reaction to, he was talking here about this kind of emotional, kind of like information theory model of emotional expressive communication, talking about this kind of idea that like, one, the idea that the purpose of music is to like induce some feeling. That's been like kind of a trite sort of underlying idea, but that there's objective ways to do that. I guess a really dumb example would be like a major chord is happy as minor chord is sad or something like that. But those associations don't, we're not totally bound to them. At least that was kind of their idea. And one way to be unbound from them is to perhaps appreciate, in some sense, the sounds that are already here. And maybe even an appropriate way to go about that is to, for you not to be the one deciding what the sounds are that you're listening to. And for Cage, that was often a process of making a piece through chance procedures. For David Dunn, it's listening to an environment. I was half tempted. I thought the inspiration would, in the moment, would tell me if that was the right thing or not. If we were to try some of this, because they're only 3 minutes. 3 minutes isn't that long. We just sat for an hour, right? That's not too bad. Actually, I'm going to read a little bit more because I think a little bit more context might be helpful. So this is in the second paragraph. In this composition, I am posing a heuristic model for musical perception proceeding from a what-if scenario. The particular what-if is a shift in the ontological status of mind from epiphenomenal to a priori. The need to let the resultant implications play out in my work as a composer arose from a confrontation with the radical view of mind and cognition asserted by traditional Buddhist concepts about the primacy of mind over matter. Such concepts emphasize the necessity to regard consciousness as the essential ground and paradigm for any correct understanding of the nature of reality. Okay, so yeah, that's kind of tying into what I was just saying. A personal dilemma arose in the process of trying to imagine what the implications for music might be when taking such a view seriously. This has led me back to the work of John Cage in his silent piece 433, in the sense that ultimately it is about this very issue. That not only does music primarily consist of the perception of sound in time, but it is the perceiver that is engaged in both organizing that perception and assigning it meaning. So just to kind of like fill that out, another big part of these guys' ideas was that it isn't that there's not going to be structure. It isn't that there's not going to be feeling. It isn't that there's not going to be all these things which happen anyway. These will all happen. That's what the mind does. What it does by doing this is it offers a space for an individual's mind to maybe explore that with a less pressured structure. Kind of like, I sort of feel like what we do in Zazen, right? We're just sitting, being who we are. Okay, cool. I think it's okay to introduce the piece though. Okay, it's kind of fun. So it reads left to right, and there's different symbols for different places to listen to.
Hey everybody, Dave here. Sorry to bust in, but at this point, Robert handed us sheet music for the listening piece and explained how all the notation works for where to direct our listening so we could do it quietly ourselves while reading off of the page, which is not going to work over podcast. So when he rings the bell, I'm just going to do this as a guided meditation for you, reading off of what the notation said, which, if we do it right, should feel like music. It's mostly about what direction and how far away to listen in various timed intervals, so that's what I'll be narrating for you. But anyway, I highly recommend looking it up and seeing the notation for yourself if you want, because that was really a work of art all on its own. It's David Dunn, Purposeful Listening in Complex States of Time.
All right. You guys want to try it? Do I get weird? It's only 3 minutes. I'll time this. Originally, this is supposed to be done in an outdoor environment by yourself, but we're doing it inside and together. But I think it's okay. It's still an environment. All right, so I'll ding this bell to start, and then I'll ding the little bell to end it.
Okay, start by directing your listening behind you as far off into the distance as you can at ground level. Now direct your hearing at a moderate distance, behind you and to the right, at body level. Now bring your focus close in, directly to your right, at sky level. Now back and to the right, at a moderate distance, listen at body level. Now directly behind you, at a moderate distance, at ground level. Now listen inside of your body. Now listening in front of you and to the right, as far off into the distance as you can, at sky level. And both inside of yourself and all around, just listening to everything you hear. Now behind you and to the left, at a moderate distance, listening at ground level. Now in front of you, and to the left, as far off into the distance as you can, listening at body level. Now straight in front of you, at a moderate distance, listening at ground level. Now listening inside of your body.
Man, I haven't done it inside. I kind of get why he wanted it outside. I hadn't thought about that. But I was like, I just noticed myself like trying to listen in that direction, and there's cars going here. I'm like, straining for like reverberations or something over there. Anyway, it's kind of cool. I think that, you know, what's interesting about this is that wherever you're at and you're doing this, you're going to be listening to stuff that you wouldn't normally pay attention to, which is kind of nice. I think it's kind of challenging in a way. It's like virtuosic listening. But because it is the way it is, and you can never know what the environment it is you're going to be in, you know, you're going to find something new, which is kind of cool. And I was wondering about this because when I first encountered this piece, I'm like, oh man, but it's all like in reference to this, right? Isn't that maybe the problem he was talking about? I was like, oh wait, but there is a thing that through this kind of concentrated effort, you're sort of, at least me, you can forget that, right? Because you're putting so much into this way or that way or whatever, and you kind of forget about this is me right here because you're just busy enough doing the thing. And I think that that kind of process can be one of those things that maybe you're busy enough that with doing that, again, maybe you become less concerned with the you that's doing it or your expectations of what's happening. Or, I mean, even the thing of like the time states and playing with the real-time sound events, the remembered sound events. I like that that's included in the intentionality of the score because that's happening anyway. I mean, if you go to a concert or whatever or you hear anything, there's that imaginative mind's working, at least for me it is. Too, and why not make it part of the thing? So anyways, I think it's kind of interesting. This kind of thing, I sort of see it like kind of a, dare I say, a skillful means for promoting or encouraging, inviting some type of more inclusive awareness. That's kind of how I think about it. Maybe I just like it. I don't know. Maybe it didn't read for you guys, but we can talk more about that in a bit. So now let's go back to the sutra. So this is the visual awareness does not move. World-honored one, suppose a visitor stops at an inn for a night for a meal. Once his stay is ended or the meal is finished, he packs his bags and goes on his way. He's not at leisure to remain, but if he were the innkeeper, he would not leave. By considering this example of the visitor, the one who comes and goes, and the innkeeper, the one who remains understood what the visitor signifies. He represents transience. Again, suppose the morning skies have cleared after a rain, then a beam of pure light from the rising sun may shine through a crack in a door to reveal some motes of dust obscuring the air. The dust moves, but the air is still. Thus, by consideration of this example, the dust, which as it moves obscures the air, and the air, which itself remains still, I understood what the dust may signify. It represents motion. The Buddha said, so it is. Thereupon the thus come one before the assembly made a fist with his wheel-lined fingers, and having made that fist, he opened his hand again. Once his hand was open, he made the fist again and said to Ananda, what did you see just now? Ananda said, I saw the thus come one before the assembly open and close his hand over his resplendent wheel-lined palm. The Buddha said to Ananda, you saw me here before the assembly open and close my hand. Was it my hand that opened and closed, or did your visual awareness open and close? Ananda said, it was the world-honored one's resplendent hand that opened and closed before the assembly. Although I saw his hand open and close, my visual awareness neither opened nor closed. The Buddha said, what moved and what was still? Ananda said, the Buddha's hand moved, but my awareness is beyond even stillness. How could it have moved? The Buddha replied, so it is. Then from his wheel-lined palm, the Buddha sent forth a ray of resplendent light that flew past Ananda to his right. Ananda immediately turned his head and glanced to the right. Then the Buddha sent a ray of light to Ananda's left. Ananda turned his head again and glanced to the left. The Buddha said to Ananda, why did you turn your head just now? Ananda said, I saw the thus come one send forth a wondrous ray of shining light which flew past me on my right, then another flew past me on my left. My head moved as I looked to the right and to the left. Ananda, when you glanced at the Buddha's light and moved your head to the right and left, was it in fact your head that moved, or else was it your visual awareness that moved? Wold, honored one, it was my head that moved. The nature of my visual awareness is beyond even stillness. How then could it have moved? The Buddha said, so it is. Then thus come one, told everyone in the assembly, all beings need to understand that whatever moves is like the dust and like a visitor, does not remain. Just now you saw that it was Ananda's head that moved, while his visual awareness did not move. It was my hand that opened and closed, while his awareness did not open or close. How can you take what moves to be your body and its environments, since they come into being and perish in every successive thought? You have lost track of your true nature, and instead you act out of delusion. Therefore, because you have lost touch with your mind's true nature by identifying yourself with the objects you perceive, you keep on being bound to the cycle of death and rebirth. When Ananda and the Great Assembly had heard the Buddha's teaching, their bodies and their minds were serene. They realized that since time without beginning, they had strayed from the fundamental true mind. Instead, they had been mistaken about the conditioned objects of perception and had made distinctions about what are in fact nothing but shadowy mental events. Now they all had awakened, and each was like a lost infant suddenly reunited with its beloved mother. Putting their palms together, they bowed to the Buddha. They wished to hear the thus come one reveal the contrasting qualities of body and mind and what is true and what is false about them, what is real and what is insubstantial, what comes into being and then ceases to be, and what neither comes into being nor perishes. Okay, so again, this thing of the objects being identified with the objects of our awareness, being attached to those objects, that's one thing. To hear a sound as a sound and identify it and sort of understand it as separate from you is one thing. And then there's the other thing of what is being aware of that? What is doing the listening? And that's kind of what Pauline Oliveira has kind of talked about a lot is, can you listen to your listening? Can you, maybe another way to put it, can you become aware of your awareness? What is that thing which is fundamentally pervading all of this, which can't be pinned down to one thing or another because it's not one thing or another? I don't know. I think that's a great place to jump off from. And on top of that, listening to listening, what is doing the listening? I mean, I think about that. Who is the one which is me that's doing this listening? Is it? I have so many ideas about me and who I think I am. To pin that down seems strange. So I don't know. And we'll get more into that next time about the five skandhas and all of that. Okay, cool. All right, so what to do with all this? I don't know. For me, all this stuff, it's like wherever I'm at, it's really nice to be able to just be and appreciate things a little more like they are with a little bit less expectation. I think that this kind of music, the sutra kind of encourages that. There's no reason why sound can't be appreciated wherever you're at. You know what I mean? It's always there. There's always the ability to do that. And there's always something to investigate, and I don't know, something to find. I think it's so often the case that we think that something has to be dramatic or highly structured or whatever, but again, there's always going to be structures we can find in our minds, and we have that freedom in our own being to be able to see that with what's there, with what's here, with what's happening with all of it. So I'm losing steam. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I did want to end, because of all these shadowy references, I thought I'd end with a John Cage quote and then we can open up for a talk. It's a short one. Oh, brief little introduction. He's talking about Morton Feldman, who was another composer, a contemporary of his. This is John Cage saying this, who had a process that was just totally intuitive. It was just like, he would just sit down and write, no judgment, like whatever came to mind. And then when he felt that it was time to stop, he just stopped. It was just like that kind of simple sort of thing. But he wrote a lot of quiet experimental music, and he was also influential. So he's talking about him when he says Feldman. I remember now that Feldman spoke of shadows. He said that the sounds were not sounds, but shadows. They are obviously sounds. That's why they are shadows. Every something is an echo of nothing. All right, that's it. Got any thoughts?
Hey, Robert. Thanks for this talk. I really liked it. It's very interesting. I think I'm confused, though, because when Buddha says that the visual awareness does not move, his visual awareness to me sounds like the mind that is dependent on perceived objects, but then it sounds like also he's talking about the full awakening if it doesn't move. And when I read this part of the Surangama Sutra too, I was like confused by that as well. Because he asks, like, you know, when he opens his hand and closes it, is it like, did my hand open and close, or did your mind open and close? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of like both, man.
Yeah. And neither. Yeah. Both and neither.
Right.
And there's a lot of this, right? There's also like the location of the mind one. Like those examples, I remember reading those and I was just like, what?
Yeah.
But I think it points to that you can't, if anything, it points to you can't say where it is or where it is not.
Yes, I definitely can't.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if that was. I'm sorry, Jason. Forgive me.
No, it's good to know that you can't answer it either.
So I have a question about awareness doesn't move, because I really like the sound of that. But what I was thinking about is like when I'm sitting Zazen and I get a really good like daydream going, I mean, I guess I'm not moving. I'm sitting completely still, but my attention is definitely not what is going on around me. So I guess my question is attention different than awareness? And what does that look like?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think there's different ways to talk about awareness, but yeah, I think attention, when I hear attention, I think of I think of attention more as like a focused, like kind of like oriented towards something specific, and mm-hmm. awareness is something a bit more inclusive. Mm-hmm. It's tricky though, because awareness, like for instance, in this sutra, like fundamental awareness, true nature, they're kind of sometimes used interchangeably, but it's, I don't know, awareness is hard because it's like, if you talk about fundamental awareness, then you're not talking about a thing. It's not a thing that's separate from everything else, but right. but it's not a thing. It's inclusive of this. To me, attention, like you're excluding something. I'm just thinking about words here. I don't know. But I think that's helpful, right? I like to think about that, about attention and awareness and what the mind's doing. If you think about attention, you think about awareness, what kind of orientation does that reflect in your own conscious state? Isn't kind of thinking about all of that sort of like paying attention to your own perception, which that's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks.
Thank you.
Oh my God, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing all. This is really great. Yeah, the notation thing was a lot of fun. I found it really interesting. When I'm sitting there and it took me a minute to, I had to kind of go through it once, kind of get the pattern, get the notation, then see how it works. Now my mind can kind of like do it more naturally, which was nice. And then like there was melody happening, not just from what's happening in the environment, but even just as you like those little directions to like move your directions, like, oh no, that's that mental motion, whatever it was, that's a melody. And like it was kind of, yeah, it was really neat. I almost feel like it would be fun to take those and use them kind of like mantras. Or if I took a pattern and could remember it, I could then sit on any park bench anywhere and like have that be my memorized melody. So I don't have to think about it. So I think it's so cool about this. I've always thought that we're missing something, which is that there's guided meditations in this world. But for some reason, whenever we go to meditate, we always think it's for self-improvement reasons or spiritual, whatever. It's like, why not just for fun? We go and watch a movie without trying to like self-improve. Why not have a guided meditation where it's, let's just go to the deep dark cave for fun, man. Do something kind of cool with that. It's like an art form. It's like, oh, cool. They're doing it. Like that is kind of what that is. I think that's really neat. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, totally. Like I don't, you know what else I thought of with the whole like guided meditation thing is it's always telling you, I don't know, it's always telling you to like do something. And it kind of comes with a little bit of pressure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you said, why not just have fun with this too? I think there's a lot to explore with this kind of thing. And when I first did it, I was sort of like, man, it's moving kind of quickly. I don't feel like I'm like really getting into like deep into these things. But then I was like, oh, well, that's just like the character of the thing or the style of the thing. And it's kind of like these, I think the quick pace is like intentional to just have that attention like really up or whatever. That's like part of the character of it. But it is interesting to think about the melody of the mind changing like moving through space and time and how you can apply that in different environments. I think it's pretty fun. Thanks, everybody. Don't forget to donate. If you can't, don't do it. But if you can, that's awesome. Do we have any?
Yes, we do have announcements. Tomorrow night, Sunday night. Oh, tomorrow, two things. Sarah C.